options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Thanks for listening to the HedgEye Investing Summit, featuring conversations with some of the sharpest minds in investing. To get access to the other 8 HedgEye Investing Summit conversations, and for more great investing content, go to HedgEye.com.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back to the Investing Summit. I just said to Ben Hunt, you know, I get to go back to back. You know, I get to go from DDB, Danielle, to Ben Hunt. It's you guys aren't trying to scare the hell out of people. It's just that people should be aware and in some cases afraid. I struggle a lot. I mean, our business is actually built in the struggle or in the arena of fighting against the narratives or the, wanted to start with that. Because you can sit there and look at every rate of change data series like Danielle and I just essentially reviewed on government spending, all the line items, the rates of change of inflation, et cetera, and then you can just turn on what you call fiat news, and I can hear all, not a non-version, the opposite of what I'm looking at.
Sometimes, for sure.
So
for
can you start with that? Just because you say 99%, I think you say of what people consume is fiat news.
Yeah, and of course it's taken from the same idea as fiat money, meaning that it's not, fiat money is not counterfeit money, right? But it's made up money.
Yeah.
It's opinion presented as money, the opinion being full faith and credit of the U.S. government for the, you know, fiat dollars. It's exactly the same thing with almost everything we consume as when we watch CNBC, or watch Bloomberg, much less watch one of the political stations, a Fox or CNN, with what we read on Wall Street Journal, what we read in the FT. Mm-hmm. All of our sources of information are dominated by opinion presented as news. Mm-hmm. And it makes total sense, right? Because we've had a real transformation in the structure of media over the last 10 to 12 years, where every media outlet is now a 24/7 news channel, right? And that includes not just the obvious 24/7 news channels,
right,
like a CNN or Fox or CNBC, but it also includes things like the New York Times,
yep,
the Wall Street Journal. Big corporations, media corporations, where it's no longer, oh, we print our newspaper once a day and stories above the fold or below the fold and that's it. It's now all the time you've got to be presenting content.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough news, as in information, here's the unemployment rate, right? There's not enough news to fill what's required to run a 24/7 news operation. So what do? You bring in pundits, talking heads, regular commentators, the regular columnists, to give you their opinion, mm-hmm, as if it were news. And the most prominent columnist, right, opinion giver of all, would be large corporations, mm-hmm, and governments. Right? So it's not fake news. That's not what we track.
Mm.
What we track, though, is the language that, and you can really track this, the language that's used to present opinion as fact in a way that we are hardwired to respond to. And, you know, there are simple ways you can kind of look for this stuff, Keith. I mean, if somebody is saying something and say, scientists say, or as many people are talking about, right? That's a very common use of word choice grammatical structures to make you, to give credibility to opinion that's being presented as fact.
Mm-hmm.
When people use lots of adverbs and adjectives, in the news they're reporting. This is a way of presenting a slant, or a direction,
right,
to what we would otherwise call news. And we really are hardwired to respond to this.
Yeah, neurologically, I mean, Trump really was fine-tuning psychologically in that. I mean, repeating the same thing, and even Biden now copies him. He'll repeat, and the adjectives, like, they're Trumpian in that sense, where if you just keep saying it over, and that's why he actually struggled. I don't know if you remember when he presented at the UN, where everyone has an earpiece,
yeah,
and he had no cues, right?
So effective politicians have always understood this, right? What's different today is that everyone is in on the act.
Yeah.
Right? So what does it mean to be an effective CEO today? It's, can you tell a story?
Right.
And because that's what gives you a multiple,
mm-hmm,
right? And this is one of the things when you start thinking about it, what is a multiple? It's a story.
Mm-hmm. So it's the believability a of a story.
Right. The fact is, okay, here are the cash flows.
Yeah.
Right? What multiple do you put on those cash flows? Right? What cash flows do you look at? Which ones do you not look at? This is all story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what makes for an effective CEO today. It's not, oh, can I get an additional, you know, turn of leverage out of this plant, or can I, you know, improve the utilization capacity of this, you know, manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
That's not it.
No.
Can I tell a story that gets a better multiple,
yeah,
on my business?
The most glaring example of this probably, well, not just this year, in our career, and you and I, it's not our first rodeo, but was AI. I mean, if you guys can show the chart, and we still have it, we definitely have it, because I'll keep it for the rest of my life.
Good, yeah.
But AI mentions relative to S&P ODT call buying, you know, and these things quite literally went vertical, but also the word count of CEOs on their calls that immediately following that. We were counting every single one of them, the mentions on the moves. I mean, if you couldn't mention it, you couldn't tell the story of your company. I mean, Arm Holdings came public all of a sudden again with that narrative. I mean, it's not like the company really changed. I mean, according to plenty of analysts, and the stock would support it. So there's the chart. I mean, that was a beauty. Like that was we have never seen anything like that in terms of, well, first of all, the structure of the options market allows for,
mm-hmm,
it. But we're talking, if I take your fiat news framework and put it inside of the structure of the machine itself perpetuates that sucker faster than ever before.
It does, and we, as if you're professionally involved in the market, we've learned that, you know, it becomes its own reality.
Yeah.
Right?
It
really does. And so they say everyone's in on the act today. Before it was AI, I mean, you remember this, I'm sure, the companies that would mention something to do with blockchain,
yeah,
or crypto, right? Where you'd even change the name of the company.
It happened before, and it wasn't true.
And this is the big point, Keith, which is that what we're describing here, it happens over and over and over again. It's not just that, you know, we have devised a system where we present opinion as fact and news, but it's that we tell the same, I like to call them narrative archetypes, story arcs.
Yeah.
We tell them over and over and over again. There is a set of words and grammatical structures that we use to say we're bullish about something.
Mm-hmm.
And so what today's technology, big data, big compute, allows one to do is to actually measure this and,
mm-hmm,
see these patterns recurring over and over and over, mm-hmm, again, and their systematic impact on price.
It's an amazing thing. My partner and our director of research comes to me a couple weeks ago, and he says, you know how well you score on storytelling? And I'm like, no, probably pretty low. I mean, my first paper at Yale in English Lit was deemed ungradable. So, but he was showing me this new software, which has been super powerful for us,
yep,
to score each of our, because we're a content company, right? I mean,
yep,
we write.
You are storytellers.
Exactly. So he showed, he said, okay, look, here's your, and kind of like succinct to verbose. And what you find is the reason why I score higher is because I write a little bit more like, not like Hemingway in terms of the words, but the,
right,
structure. short sentences, less adjectives.
100%.
Spacing, the reason why a newspaper is organized that way with spacing and pictures is because it's easier to read. You don't feel like it's a job. It's like I can just consume this. And it was kind of like a thing that I always knew, but now through AI, our whole bloody firm is going to be a better writer.
Well, it's never been more important.
Yeah.
And for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I mentioned earlier is that our entire media system has changed to be 24/7, always on.
Yeah.
Corollary to that is that we've changed ourselves to be 24/7 available.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? I mean, we all carry around, I like to call it my little dopamine machine, my little iPhone, where I make myself available to the messaging constantly. And it's because it hits directly my, you know, my neurochemicals, right? That's why I call it my dopamine machine. And so...
I'm put mine aside here.
Right? Yeah, I know. I had to put mine off so that it doesn't go off, right? And I don't know about you, Keith, but I get a little antsy if I'm, where's my phone? It's been, you know, 30 seconds. You know, is my phone in my pocket? No, it's not. What?
Yeah.
You start to feel a little nervous.
Yeah.
You know, again, I'm sure I'm like a lot of people listening to this, but the last thing I look at when I go to bed is my phone. Mm-hmm. The first thing I look at when I wake up in the morning is my phone.
Of course.
Not my wife, my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And how pathetic and sad is that?
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got an entire media system that's designed to constantly be barraging us with messages. We've done to ourselves an openness. We've left ourselves open to be constantly absorbing these messages. And the third piece of this, and this is what you were intimating with the storytelling software or how things are designed on the newspaper and the like, is that it's not just that everyone's in on the act, whether it's CEOs or politicians or bankers. It's that they've gotten pretty good at it.
Very good, yeah.
So when you look at, I'll call it the big three, big media, big politics,
mm-hmm.
big tech, what we've been engaged in or the subject to for the last, certainly the last decade, and it continues to accelerate, is massive, I'll call it A-B testing with what works and what doesn't work to generate our engagement. Because that's the coin of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, oh, I like this, and it's not, oh, I hate this. It's likes or hates.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, disliking something, which is why fear kind of sells, is that it generates more of those, it's norepinephrine, not dopamine, but it generates more of those neurochemicals with us. So, you know, starting with Meta and Facebook, certainly Twitter, all of the algos are designed to drive engagement. That's what the content does, and that's how all the content is filtered and then evolves.
Mm-hmm.
Are you good at generating engagement?
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, your style is very good at generating engagement. I'm not surprised at all that you would score highly on the storytelling stage. I score pretty well too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think all of the people you've had on the show were effective storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're a CEO, whether you're running a research company, whatever it is your job requires today, it's never been more important to be an effective storyteller.
I hit on this with Bill Cohen yesterday.
Yeah.
Do you know Bill?
Sure.
He's a phenomenal writer, great researcher, which is what perpetuates his ability to communicate, you know, in books, long form. And I think, I mean, David Salem's a huge fan of yours, for example. So many people are. Like, your ability to communicate in long form is right at the top of the game, right? Like, that's something that you're well known for.
That's what I'm good at. Yep.
And that's it's a huge contribution to our profession, right? I mean, because... Yeah, I know. We all know.
Well, that's generous of you, but thank you.
No, we know a lot of people. I mean, you wouldn't be in this business if on paper you weren't scoring as intelligent,
mm-hmm.
right?
True.
You know, it's our profession is decked to the halls with intellect, but it's not decked to the halls with people who step outside of their buy-side suit and or away from their desk, which is not in a suit or maybe ever again, and actually have the courage to communicate their thoughts.
Yep. Now,
they have opinions. We'll hear them all the time at the bar or wherever,
for sure.
At the hockey rink. But you definitely, and well, I think that that's, just to kind of finish that, I think that there's a huge difference, what I was saying with Bill, like when you say something on the margin, it's probably after I've already read a bunch of what you've written. I have your context. I mean, if you tell me that the rate of change of government spending is slowing, I'm going to say that's bullshit. Like, I could tell you what's right or what's wrong if there's a number in it.
Yep.
But the media has this, like, dopamine function with no real context, with no real experience, and here the rest of us are. To me, that's a big opportunity, is communicating more effectively with the tools that we have. Like, we're not going to change the media, the politics, or the big tech, the big three. But we can influence it, you know, with our ability to use their tools.
Like all skills or tools, it can be used for good, it can be used for ill.
Yeah.
Right? So, and what I mean by using it for ill is, we were talking earlier about fiat news, right? Opinion presented as news. You know, one of the things, we get everything that's published in the English language anywhere in the world overnight, and we analyze it through our tools. And, I was looking at through some of the articles that were published yesterday that were at the top of our fiat newsiness, where they're really describing opinion, but it's presented in a way that makes you think, oh, this is how I should understand this. And what all this language has in common is they're not telling you just, here's the news, poll results show XYZ, or data series, you know, shows government spending increasing at an accelerating pace, but no, how you should think about that, right? What's the context? So you see this all the time, and it's very overt sometimes if you kind of look at, you kind of train yourself to look at the words. What does this poll mean, Keith? You know, the commentator might ask. What's the right context for understanding this data series?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yes.
So we're using our words to, and you actually see this physically a lot of times with people, politicians mostly, or central bankers sitting in front of a camera, they'll shake their finger at you. I mean, literally shake a finger at you.
Yeah.
Because that's the verbal cue to say, pay attention now. I'm going to tell you how to think about this fact.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see all the time, right? And you'll see it today in whatever market summary headlines you see in the journal or on CNBC. S&P up 5 points. S&P down 5 points. And then they'll tell you why.
Yes.
As often or not, the answer for the why is variance, right? but you're not going to sell newspapers.
Brownian motion and variance?
Yeah, yeah. You're not going to say, well, it's just, you know, some days it's up, some days it's down. It's like, you can't make a career out of saying variance.
No,
that's
exactly.
You have to say why.
You have to, and you say it with authority.
And you say it with authority.
And nothing's worse than somebody who's ignorant, incompetent, inexperienced, speaking with authority. I tweeted this yesterday. I got to say it because I'm not going to hide from what I tweet. If I tweet, that's what I believe.
Right.
But I mean, I can get in a car if it's between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. If Scott Wapner's on on CNBC, like he is I called him the most insufferable poser that I've heard in a while. And that's what makes him like relevant, is that the underlying summary is his opinion. You know, it's not a question. It's that market should go up, right? I mean,
I think there's a lot of competition
for that
position that you're describing.
Right. But this is a guy who's like a reporter in Dallas. He doesn't even.
I get it. No, and. What I'm saying is that we can identify for ourselves, right? We can't escape the barrage of opinion presented as fact. But there really are, I think, a few telltale signs that we can kind of recognize. For example, in going back to this notion of, you know, I'm going to look at my Bloomberg, Bloomberg anywhere. I'll look at the news feed at 4 o'clock today. Actually, 4:05, because it takes some time. You know, this stuff happens clockwork because it's all been tested on, you know, what we need to say.
Yeah.
There will be a headline on Bloomberg that will say the following. Markets up or down, whatever happens today, comma, as fact.
Yeah.
So markets up or down as Israel responds to Hamas. Markets up or down today, comma, as Federal Reserve says something. Now, what they're doing with that construction, that headline, is that they're implying the causality. What they're saying in the way we are hardwired when we read that headline, mm-hmm. what our brain, whether we're thinking consciously about it or not, particularly if we're not thinking about it consciously, we say, what that's telling us is market was up or down because
right.
of the next statement that they make. This is done absolutely intentionally.
Yeah.
Pretty much every day you'll see on the Journal or on Bloomberg mm-hmm. a headline, the market summary headline, will be in that direct use of words, comma, as.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about we can train ourselves to identify this so that we can step back, maintain a little bit of critical distance between what all we call the missionaries, what they're trying to tell us for how to think about the news, so we can think for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where there's opportunity. It's one thing.
100%.
Like, I rarely criticize something without having a better way on the other side, a solution to it. Mm-hmm. I'll be critical of Wapner, because if you're listening to that, I'm going to be on the other side of you. I'm going to take advantage of you. And I do. And we, like, since July, it's been like a feeding frenzy, quite literally. You know, underneath the surface of this market has been a tremendous amount of carnage. And there's been, you know, not just this market, but I mean, if you look at global equities, you look at European equities, they stopped going up in April. You look at, you know, anything that somebody with any wherewithal that can look cross asset classes would look at, you'd say, okay, I want more of that from Wapner because I need some bids to hit.
You need information to fade.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you look at, guys, if you can go to slide, I think it's slide 46, this became, this is kind of, there's a point to us going, you know, talking about this fiat news and how do you make money on it?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, so this was, I don't know if you can see that up there, but it, you know, this soft landing became, in our vernacular, the contra signal embedded in that. The timing of that in July was sublime. Look, go to the next chart, actually, where you show Google searches. Look at this. You know, soft landing, of course, is, you know, to your point, comma, it's an opinion that we didn't have the recession that you're all fearing. That's what that is. That in the history of my career, soft landing has never been a thing. Certainly not an order of magnitude like that.
It's not a thing. It's not a thing.
Or no landing. That's even better. Get on a plane and don't land.
but here's how we made money from that, right? So we started writing about this in late July, because what happened in late July was that the hard landing narrative, the story,
yes,
it went away.
Big time.
It didn't just diminish. It went away. And that's actually pretty rare. Right? So when you're kind of looking at these patterns that happen, and almost always there's, we call it like narrative bids.
You call it that internally?
Yeah, that's absolutely what we do.
That's awesome.
Right? So you can think of this in lots of different ways. For example, no matter how expensive a stock gets or a national market gets, right? So we're looking at, you know, Canada and Australia, for example, is what we're looking at last year. There's always, no matter how expensive it gets, there's almost always a narrative bid, meaning somebody saying, oh, it's still a buying opportunity. It's still cheap if you look at it on these metrics. It's still, but every once in a while, that narrative bid will go away. And when that narrative bid goes away, you want to be underweight or you want to short that market.
Right.
Right. So what happened in July, as you're describing, is that the narrative bid for recession went away. Now, how do you make money from that? Well, that narrative bid recession's right around the corner, or it's going to be tough, or this is going to happen, that puts a lid on longer-dated interest rates, mm-hmm. right? It acts as a something to push down on the 10-year rates, right? Why? Because if there is a recession, if you think a recession's coming, then you want to own bonds. Mm-hmm. What we saw when that narrative bid went away, we started right back, look, there's a real possibility for longer dated interest rates, 10-year treasuries,
yes.
to become unmoored.
To the upside.
To the upside.
And bond yields, downside in bonds.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. Upside in rates, downside in price.
Mm-hmm. Right? So you must have made a pile on that.
It's a really effective trade for us.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's, when you kind of think of these things in, again, in narrative terms, and it's an invisible world. We all know we're immersed in it, and you guys were picking up on it, right? That the hard landing story vanished to be replaced by, oh, soft landing or no landing. Right? But the hard landing narrative was keeping
yeah.
the lid on
yep.
10-year interest rates and mm-hmm. 30-year interest rates. When that's removed,
so that was a great signal. I mean, it's just gravity. If something goes to its prior threshold, in the case of the 10-year yield, 4.25 was the prior cycle high, and keeps failing there, then that's saying. There was, and by the way, people did, if they were long stocks at the end of the cycle or peak of the cycle in 2021, they got buried in 2022. So a lot of their fear about a recession was born of how much money they lost. So it's always yeah. rear view looking. But as soon as you got through that, like our signals on short utilities, short real estate more aggressively, like rate sensitivity is what we kept saying.
Yep. Yep.
I mean,
yep.
some these declines in utilities stocks we haven't seen since 2008.
It was a crazy stretch there, like with utilities. I mean,
when utilities get exciting, that's not a bullish signal.
No, it's really not. But what I think you're picking up a lot of times in these the historical patterns, right, is you're marrying that with what was happening in narrative world at the
yes.
same time.
Exactly.
Can be really effective.
Yep.
Right, because we do tell these stories over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, or almost always, some sort of recession is coming narrative out there. And when it's really pronounced, how to say this? Basically, these narrative, we think, becomes actionable when either everyone's beating the drums about something
mm-hmm.
or when nobody's beating the drums about something. Because, you know, those are the times where, all right, these narratives will have a specific impact on our behavior, mm-hmm. whether we like it or not, right? It mm-hmm. does have we're hardwired to respond to this stuff. So, you know, if the drum beating is really loud, like every morning you're getting in your
yep.
Bloomberg email, somebody is telling you, oh my God, Japan is going to be great. You know, what a great market, Japan. And you see that in your morning email at Bloomberg,
yeah.
it's probably time to fade it.
Yeah. We address this mathematically. If it's like it's just mathematical rules based. So if then, if the market were long Japan, mm-hmm. if it's at the top end of the range, and if our conscious stream is just buzzing about how bullish this is, sell some. That's it. You'd sell some anyway. It's up
100%.
And that's the simplest way that I can say mathematically I've yep. unmoored myself from this from. And started to capitalize on it. I mean, it's an amazing thing to watch. So now, you go 80 basis points from mm-hmm. the day that Wall Street was begging for the JOLTS number to be their new messiah. Like,
yep.
okay, bond yields gotta go down, we can make money
yep.
again.
Yep.
We've been getting killed for too long. Since July, we've been getting smoked. Bond yields rip, so then the beating of the drums are that they're going up too fast. That became a very heavy beat. And then you get the Wapners of the world that are, you know, celebrating dovish Fed speak this week because now, oh, that makes the bond yields go down. Because the fear now is that the bond yields are going the way that you said.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm pretty sure you wrote this. Yeah, you thought that, you think that into next year bond yields could go, you know,
so,
higher.
What I think, so that answer is yes, right? But what I also think is that this trade, higher yields, this trade was discovered, right?
And quickly.
Well, I mean, it took a while. So it was 2 weeks ago when you had Jamie Dimon come out and talk about it,
yep.
when you had Larry Fink come out and talk about it, saying, oh, yeah, you know, I think, you know, bond yields could go to 7 or something like that. When a prominent missionary, again, to use this terminology, comes out.
Missionary.
And Jamie Dimon and Larry, those are very prominent missionaries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When they come out and they say, this is the trade, that means the discovery phase of this is over. And you're in the it becomes a mainstream phase. Mm-hmm. Now it gets talked about by the Scott Wapners of the world and, you know, the whole CNBC desk and the like. The easy money is always made in the discovery phase.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And once it's discovered, once everyone's talking about it, it becomes a bit of a slog.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what we wrote about is it's discovered. It doesn't mean to abandon the trade,
mm-hmm.
but for rates to go up from here, it requires a new narrative catalyst,
right.
of which I think there are many,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to take a new narrative catalyst, like we saw with the recession narrative disappearing.
Well, I mean, right? look.
That narrative catalyst happened. You saw the result. Now that's done. I can name for you, you know, 5 or 6 other narrative catalysts we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
If that happens, then I think we've got another leg higher in rates. Until they happen, I think we stick around here between whatever, 4.6 and 4.8. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of like the range here for what happened from that initial narrative catalyst of there's no recession possible.
Yeah, that's really good. And I want to get into those points. I just don't want to lose where we're at in terms of like the structure of the solution.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to criticize the, what I call, again, I call it macro tour. I have so many nicknames for it. That's why they love me, right? I mean, it's like, you know, drawdown Josh Brown, or we talk about, you know, macro tourists. That's what it is. You're essentially jumping from headline to headline. And, you know, it could have been Israel, and then tomorrow
yep.
it's going to be CPI, but you're
yep.
never thinking about it holistically or all at once. You're not assuming that the world's nonlinear. It's this fractal pattern that's constantly updating itself, inclusive of everything that's happening, not just what you're focused on as the media today. So if you go back, like my entire belief system in terms of how I structured my process, my asset allocation process, decision making mm-hmm. process, is all based on Mandelbrot's, you know, The Misbehavior of Markets.
Love that book.
So your premise starts so far away. I don't even know if Wapner is getting way too much airtime. Hey, how you doing, man? But it's like the primary assumption, based on his observations using, at the time, a big mainframe computer measuring and mapping everything from cotton prices to whatever he wanted to look at, was that most of the time, at least the majority of the time, what you see in terms of a market move is Brownian motion. It's nothingness. But there's a particular point in time where, in this case, the machine figures out that you are entering something real, a breakout or a phase transition, just like you'd see
yep.
in natural life.
Yep.
You know, whether it be an earthquake or it be anything that is. And that, to me, is what you just said. So we had this phase transition. Inflation went far higher than any pundit or economist or the Fed could have possibly thought.
Right.
It corrected. Bond yields did this, but now they're doing that. And you get these consolidation periods where the biggest test for me is the period you're in. Like, I'm shorting the crap out of utilities ahead of tomorrow's CPI report.
Mm-hmm.
That is a tangible catalyst where we have a model where
yep.
we have an acceleration in the number. So if I'm not going to be there on green shorting utilities tomorrow, I'm really not staying with the view that bond yields are going to keep surprising to the upside, even though they don't have to surprise as much. They just have to maintain their trend. So on that, like, Brownian motion is one thing, but trends are how you make money.
So here's the, I think what we're trying to do is to start from that base that you're describing,
mm-hmm.
which is predicated, this is Mandelbrot's thing, and it was, you know, Jim Simons at Rentec. It's what all stat arb guys do, right? It's based on structured data,
mm-hmm.
right? You're looking at historical patterns of price, volume, fundamentals, and it's structured data.
Yep.
Wholeheartedly believe on that. What I'm saying is that in addition to that, we can now analyze rigorously with the same tools that we used to be that we've applied for a while now on structured data, we can apply those same tools to unstructured data. Right? Because my belief is that we have seen a divorce from the impact of reality with the words that we use to tell you how to think about that reality, right? And I'll use kind of a CPI report as a good example. Last two CPI reports, the day before the release, the journal has put, we would call this above the fold, right? But so it's one of their primary articles on the online version. They published a big piece, headline piece, about why you should understand that a CPI increase was not to be a problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they started they started preparing readers, investors.
Yep.
They wanted to tell you how to think about that CPI number that's starting to notch back up again. You know, nobody cared about, base year effects and all this other stuff. And no. But now that this is what Wall Street wants, we want cheaper money, right?
Yep.
All of this is an exercise to cajole, convince, threaten the Fed to make for cheaper money.
Exactly.
Right? All of this, that's what it's all for. Yeah. And you saw that media effort being made before each of the last two CPI reports.
Yes.
Right. So my point is there is reality, there is structured data, and there is the unstructured data. Understanding that and the patterns of that, we think are a really interesting and helpful combination with the structured data work.
Yeah, you the conditional factoring, or for those of you that don't do math that way or build your models that way, like just marinating something. You want to marinate something for a required outcome when you take out the whole process to get it to where you want, well cooked. Okay? If you're sitting there and you're at one of these elite organizations, investing organizations that have capitalized on lower for longer rates, free money, et cetera, forever, you're damn right you're lobbying for the Fed to stop and to have some dovish Fed speak. There was a woman from the Fed who was in, I guess they had her speak in Morocco last night, who was very hawkish, but that's not going to be mentioned today. That's not part of the marinade. We're not going to marinate anything with that. I still have on the shelf, I still want to get your items on what could get bond yields to go
sure.
up. But on that question, because you have another great quote in here, like our political environment will only improve following a period of crisis and conflict. This really kind of harkens back to the fourth turning, where towards the fourth turning, which is this situation where there's the state, the elites, and the rest of us. The elites have to be, maybe are in the midst of their crisis now, and I think that is the elites on Wall Street, the beggars of the cowbell and the lower rates. We may be seeing the sword of Damocles may just be what we thought it was, which is rising cost of capital.
100%, right? And I believe very much that it is the real economy, by which I mean the actual purchasing and pricing decisions made by households and corporations, that really drives what happens in the world.
Yep.
And so my strong view is that inflation is well embedded, right, within the actual decisions that households make and that corporations make. And that, there are different ways to say this, but the basic idea is you confuse the map for the territory. So when the Fed, and I get it, right, we're trying to look at inflation expectations, and so we're going there kind of two ways to do it. We can look at surveys where you ask somebody, what are your expectations for inflation in 1 year or 3 years? And the answer they're going to give you, and you got to think about who you're asking also, is going to be basically nobody really has an opinion for what inflation is 3 years from now, right? It's you're asking this, and it's very much conditioned by what is happening right now.
Yes.
Right? Or the other approach is, okay, let's look at whatever, five-year forwards and get a market answer to what we think inflation is going to be from now. That is also, it's so much a function of what's happening today that because this is, it's the old story of, you know, you come across a guy and he's looking down at the sidewalk underneath the street lamp, and you say, what are you looking for? He said, well, I lost a dollar. I'm looking for the dollar that I lost. He said, okay, well, I'll help you look. And he said, well, are you sure you lost it here? He said, no, I think I lost it over there, but the light's better over here.
That's great. Right?
So the Fed, Wall Street tries to make these predictions about inflation
yeah.
expectations because this is where the light is.
Mm-hmm.
We have polling data and we have market data on five-year, whatever, 10-year forward, you know, swap, you know, interest rates. Interest rates, our expectations are not from Michigan survey data. Our inflation expectations are based on you guys sitting around here and saying, well, what price are we going to set for our service for next year?
Yeah, 100%.
It's faced by, you know, a family, you know, husband and wife that think, well, you know, what can we afford?
Mm-hmm.
What does our job prospects look like? And you and I are both on enough of these decision-making entities. I know that we're all thinking in terms of embedded inflation, and we can raise our prices by this, and we've got to increase wages by that. You're always increasing prices by a little bit more than you're increasing wages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, this is the new world we're in.
Yeah.
And so that's the ultimate driver, to your point, of what's happening in the real economy. What we have to navigate as investors is our belief that that is what is real, against the unstructured data, the fiat news, the people shaking their fingers
right.
at you and telling you, don't believe what you see or you feel. Look over here,
mm-hmm.
because we want you to act in a very different way.
I was saying this in another conversation. Go to Stu Leonard's, which, you know, you're local Connecticut, and you stand outside Saturday morning and see a mother or father with their three kids and ask them if five-year forwards are indicating that inflation on this trip is going to go down, and then go get the guy who's sitting there, mostly white guys, reading their barons in the car, you know, saying, oh, inflation's anchored.
Yeah.
It's just so bad, man.
That's it.
Right?
That's exactly it.
I mean, you could get in a fight by going, in fact, Target would tell you that, no, they. Moreover, they're just going to steal it from us now because they can't afford it. And it's a major problem in the country. So you get all these issues that are real. And then, you know, to that end, fiat news has a lot of components of fake news because it's just patently false. So on that, I do this thing on Twitter, by the way, in the morning, because I go through every commodity rate of change. I mean, it's the old Mandelbrot training, which is I measure map everything. We have plenty of analysts, plenty of computing power. One of my analysts, Rooster, is famous for blowing up the laptops, you know. But you don't need a high-powered computer to measure and map the rate of change of the price of butter just hitting an all-time high, cattle prices, et cetera. And so I like to snag what's ripping that day because that's not going to be part of their news today. But that's what happened to prices today, you know, in the real world. So how do you, and maybe this is part of your answer. We still have 7 minutes. But what are the things, in addition to that, which you've already started with, that get... You could mention four or five things that can make bond yields go higher without any opinion from the Fed or the establishment.
So a couple of kind of very specific things, but I'm going to start with what we've been talking about, like I like to call it, mistaking the map for the territory.
That's a very good one, yeah.
Right? And nobody's calling the Fed or Wall Street out on that because we're all in it together, right? To your point, we're also there reading barons or whatever. And so it's become so ingrained in us that the way to understand inflation is through, what's the survey data? Or, you know, what's the pricing of five-year forwards? the lived experience of actual human beings ultimately reveals that to be false. So ultimately there is a, I call it an emperor's new clothes moment, mm-hmm. where, but you've been telling us that inflation is down and inflation is only 3% or whatever the official line is. There does come a time when the disjuncture between the stated reality,
yes.
fiat world, and real world, when it becomes large enough, you have an emperor's new clothes moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bad day for markets, because mm-hmm. that's what breaks the Fed or central banking credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the last thing I think that breaks, the last catalyst to watch for, and that's a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
Leading up to that, I think there are narrative catalysts that we can identify that start to, they're like mileposts on the way to that emperor's new clothes moment. For example, right, one of the things I wrote about was if crude hits 90 bucks a barrel, that creates a set of narratives of resurgent inflation. And that's exactly what we saw,
yep.
once it hit 90 bucks. Now it's back below that now, so those narratives have started to decline a little bit. But the way that narrative works is like a barge moving. And once you hit that 90 buck point, the machinery started getting into motion that, oh yeah, inflation is coming back.
Could be 100.
Could be 100, right. Now, there's going to be another, I'll say, of these moments. My guess is 3 months, maybe 4 months from now. And that moment is when home prices, which is measured in the, again, it's confusing map for territory. You know, we don't actually measure home prices in our inflation measurements. We measure something called owner's equivalent rent,
mm-hmm.
meaning if you were actually renting your house, you know, what you would have to pay. It's very convoluted and it's very lagged.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our data today that we're getting and for the next several months are going to show that housing is disinflationary, to mm-hmm. use that phrase, right? Even though what the truth is right now, home prices are on their way back up.
Yep.
That won't get reflected in the numbers for, like I say, I think, you know, probably 3 or 4 months. When it does, that will be another, you know, surprise, inflation is embedded and it's coming back.
Yeah.
Right? So I think you have to look for that. The other thing I'm looking at pretty closely right now is what's happening in Japan.
Mm.
Why Japan? Well, the yen has taken a huge tumble, right? And in large part, it's because Japan is maintaining its policy of the central bank keeping a lid on longer-term interest rates, yield curve control, right? So that they're actually out there buying, and they've bought up most of the supply of longer-dated Japanese debt, government mm-hmm. debt, to keep their interest rates low. Our interest rates have gone up. So what's the obvious play here? Well, I'm going to borrow yen, right, and I'm going to buy higher, you know, dollar-denominated assets. That's the trade.
Mm-hmm.
That's the play.
It's been great.
And it's been great, right? Last week, the Bank of Japan intervened directly in the yen market. They mm-hmm. started buying some yen. And the half-life of their intervention was about 24 hours.
Saw that.
Right?
Yeah, at 150, right?
That's at 150. My point is this. If the Bank of Japan decides this is going to be our line in the sand, 150, and we're going to intervene to keep it from going above that, they are going to be sorely tested
mm.
with interest rate differentials the way they are now.
Mm-hmm.
You will start to see more language about testing Japan. It's a test I don't think they can satisfy, because their interest rates are too low and inflation is too high in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think you want to be looking for is the first article you see that compares the Bank of Japan to the Bank of England in 92 with Soros and Druckenmiller when they famously broke the Bank of England over an exchange rate and similar disjunctures between reality and exchange rates. The first time you see an article like that, and I think you're going to see an article like that, that's a big narrative event.
Big time.
I'll give you one more. We're seeing more and more mentions of the phrase bond vigilantes.
Yep.
Yeah, bond vigilantes, there's no such thing, right? I mean, but if you think it's a thing, then it's a thing.
Classic Ben Hunt.
Right? So it's the bond vigilantes, you know, shorthand for market discipline on, you know, the issuance of and the pricing of treasuries, fiscal discipline and the like. You're going to see a lot more mentioning of bond vigilantes. You're going to see a lot more mentioning of, with this political season, this awful political season we're going to be engaged in, a lot more talking about the fiscal irresponsibility and the like, which is all true, but it's going to be used as, here's the narrative for why yields are going to go higher. So those are the things I want to look at. This all culminates, I think, with that break in credibility, that inflation is resurgent, rates do respond, long end does come unmoored. We've had the first kind of battle in that war. Now we're in a lull where we're looking for these other narrative catalysts to occur.
Very well put.
Thank you.
And somehow I got it right to the finish line. Like, you know, just...
You're an effective storyteller, Keith.
We got it right on the screws. Thank you for articulating that. And just for being out there all the time and helping people.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a great pleasure to have you in here.
So likewise.
All right. He's Ben Hunt. I have Matt Cole up next.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.